Farming Show.
Hello, good morning, and welcome to the Easter edition of the Farming Show on Pirate 2. My name is Rob Dunn.
And I'm Emily Boughton.
Joining us on the show this morning is Essex farmer Ed Ford and co-founder of Forage Aid Charity.
We catch up with James Coombe from Dutchy Home Farm.
Plus we chat with Don Messick from the Sulphur Institute, all the way from Washington DC.
Before we welcome our guests onto the show, let's hand over to the news team for this week's farming news.
Cornish farmers have handed a petition to Downing Street demanding less power for supermarkets. They've joined thousands in a protest in London on Wednesday. Dutchy NFU chairman Chris Cardell has herds at Probus and says something has to be done about plummeting prices.
We've seen massive drops over the last 12 months to the point where it's on the brink of not being viable, I would suggest, for anybody producing milk at the moment. So everybody's having to look at their own costs and a way that they can bring alternative money into the business with a view to moving forward in the future.
In fact, Chris warns many dairy farmers in the Duchy are being forced out of the industry.
Predominantly here in Cornwall, we tend to be smaller family farms. One of our great assets of Cornwall is that we can grow grass extremely well and, you know, relatively cheaply. That is one of the main reasons why we've seen tremendous growth in the dairy industry in this part of the world for a number of years now.
Police are urging farmers who feel threatened by anti-badger cull campaigners to get in touch. It's after a list of those who've signed up was leaked and names and addresses started to appear on Facebook. Officers are pledging to act amid claims animal rights extremists are vowing to expose one farmer a day in Devon. The co-op group is offering a £40 million cash dowry to bidders on properties it acquired during the Summerfield takeover. Now, that happened nearly a decade ago, but it's understood bosses want to offload around 100 former Summerfield sites. The money's being offered in exchange for a guarantee to keep shops trading for at least 3 years. Tesco's under fire for British-sounding made-up farm names. Some, like Woodside Farm Pork or Suntrail Farm Fruit, are being used on imported foods. The National Farmers Union and the Soil Association have flagged up concerns after seven brands launched on Monday. The supermarket insists they're not supposed to mislead customers. And spring may have only just sprung, but some of the season's common events have happened weeks early. It's because of the warm winter. The Woodland Trust's Nature's Calendar has seen some of its earliest records this century for flowering bluebells and blackthorn. Hawthorn trees have also been coming into leaf much earlier, along with 60 locations of bluebells. That's up from just 22 the year before. That's the latest farming news from the Pirate 2 News Centre.
Cornwall's Farming Show on Pirate 2.
Thanks to the news team for this week's bulletin.
It's time to welcome our first guest to the show, co-founder of the Forage Aid charity, Ed Ford. Ed, welcome to the Farming Show. How are you this morning?
Yeah, really great, and thrilled to be on the show with you today.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with who you are and what you do, Ed, could you give us a bit of an introduction, please?
Okay, so I am a farmer from Essex. We have a family farm which I run with my brother and my father. I'm also heavily involved with the National Federation of Young Farmers, as well as involved with a charity called Forage Aid as well. So, a bit of everything, really.
And what's going on your home farm currently?
We are busy putting spring crops in. We've adopted a zero-till system on our farm, so we've got a new drill called a cross-slot drill, which we are currently out there using. I've just literally just walked in the office now, just from the field, having a look at how it's going. It seems to be going well. So we're doing that. We're out fertilising as well, putting fertiliser on the wheat and the rape. We are spraying as well. So, yeah, we are very, very busy.
So adopting a no-till policy, Ed, that's not something that's particularly common down here in Cornwall. What sort of soil type do you have to support that?
That's an interesting question. We're a very heavy, heavy London clay soil, probably some of the heaviest soils adopting a no-till system. And it's proving a challenge. We're learning. There's not very many people in the UK doing this system. We've got 70 acres of beans in and we're just starting on the spring barley now. Got a couple of hundred acres of spring barley to put in.
And what was the thought process behind going to a zero-till policy?
So here in Essex, we have a serious problem with blackgrass, as well as most farmers in the southeast. So that was one of the main thought processes. We've got to stop moving the soil. We've spent years and years ploughing and ruining our soil, ruining the soil structure, that sort of thing. So we wanted to change that. We also wanted to try and lower our cost of production. Global market, we're really struggling to keep the cost of production down. And by not spending all the money on fuel and all the ploughing in the autumn, we think we can get the cost down to below £100 a tonne for wheat.
Oh, fingers crossed that all goes well for you.
Thank you.
Ed, tell us a bit about your involvement with young farmers.
Oh, right. So I've been a young farmer now for 9 years. Got involved back in about 2006 and sort of went on from there, heavily involved at the club level then. Moved on to get involved in Essex County and been very active with what we do with our Young Farmers Show. Essex Young Farmers put on a very successful show every year, 14,000 people. It's on the 22nd of May this year, and we run it sort of as a commercial country show. And 3 years ago, I started getting involved with the National Young Farmers at a national level, started going to a few meetings, got involved up there, as well as at an eastern area level as well. So January this year, I was elected on as Eastern Area Chairman, which I sit on as Chairman for a year. And then also in February this year, I was elected on as National Vice Chairman of Council. So along with Chris Manley and Lindsay Martin, we're sort of the team heading up the Young Farmers this year.
So you're Chris Manley's right-hand man.
Funny you say that. I've known Chris for many years. He was actually my warden when I was in halls at Harper Adams. And got to know him then, and then didn't see him for a few years, and then started bumping into him on the Young Farmers scene sort of 3 or 4 years ago. I am his right man. We talk 3 or 4 times a week and get on like a house on fire. So yeah, no, it's good fun.
We've had Chris on the show a couple of times, Ed, and he's always come across as, you know, highly professional, very knowledgeable. But is there anything, another side of Chris Manley that you could give us that perhaps our listeners haven't seen?
He is very good fun, and it doesn't come across in the pictures, but he is actually very short. I don't want to put a number on it, but he is fairly short. He is vertically challenged. And he has a certain resemblance as well to the Milky Bar Kid.
Yes, I have seen this on Twitter and Facebook. Yeah, I can see that.
So when we were doing the campaign for getting him to national chairman, we sort of dubbed it Milky Bar Kid for Chairman.
Oh, well, that's something we didn't know about Chris Manley. Thanks for that.
I'm sure he'll be ringing me when he hears this.
I'm sure he will. I'm sure your phone will be buzzing. And why do you think Young Farmers is such an important institution?
Oh, blimey. Young Farmers has quite frankly made me the man I am today. I came home from uni, didn't have a lot of friends in the local area. You know, it can be a very isolated job, farming and living in a rural community. And, you know, Young Farmers gives you that way to get out there and meet people, like-minded people, you know, but you don't have to be a farmer to be a young farmer. But everyone who goes to Young Farmers is interested in the countryside and that sort of thing. And it's just a great way to go and meet people and gives you the opportunity to do things you wouldn't normally do, such as public speaking, competitions, go travelling around the world. I know in Essex we have a very successful training fund, which was set up a few years ago, and any member can do a little application form and they can get up to 75% of a training course funded. And I know that's also available in other counties. And it just opens up so many doors. You know, I wouldn't be in the position I am today without Young Farmers. And obviously, it goes without saying, it is the biggest unofficial dating agency in the UK.
Is that something that you've made the most of, Ed?
Yes, I have made the most of that. It's quite interesting. All the clubs in Essex here are sort of there or thereabouts around 70 years old now. When you go to all these 70th balls, on the wall, they're normally like a who married who and from what club. And they were all Young Farmers. All our parents all met through Young Farmers. And it's great now that we're all meeting their friends' children. And, you know, it's just such a good thing to be a part of.
I think that's the best pitch we've heard for Young Farmers. Well done, Ed. Tell us a bit about your involvement with Forage Aid.
Well, Forage Aid started for me back in 2014, February the 13th, I think it was. And I was at the National Council meeting of Young Farmers, which is sort of a meeting that's held 4 times a year up in Coventry. And we were sat in the meeting in the Agri Steering Group and talking all about the flooding in Somerset and that sort of thing. And then we got to the actual council meeting the next day, and a Somerset young farmer got up and sort of said how bad it was. And I thought, well, actually, we've got to do something about this. So I made a quick few phone calls to the county chairman of Essex. I was vice chairman at the time. And I said, look, we've got to get on and do this. We've got to sort this problem out. We've got to help them. And all these livestock have been evacuated off the Somerset levels. So he said, well, we've made a healthy profit on the New Year's Eve party. Why don't you take that money and go and spend it on some forage? So I did. We booked the lorries in for the week after, and I thought, yeah, that's really great. Two lorries, woohoo, let's get them going down there. And then I got in the car and sort of drove home. I thought, well, actually, I think we can do more than this. So I got home and I wrote a text. I wrote a text to every single farmer I had in my phone book from Essex, which was about 50-odd farmers. And the next thing I knew, my phone was off the hook for the next 2 weeks. Through social media and that sort of thing, the word spread of what we were doing. We set up a collection point at my farm in Essex. And one thing led to another. The next thing, it was June, and we'd sent 55 loads down to Somerset from Essex. So that was sort of unofficial, really. We were calling it forage aid, but forage aid was a just sort of a concept at that time. And then it was, I suppose, we built a really good relationship up with all the farmers down there, and a few of those farmers down there, and Andrew Ward up in Lincolnshire wanted to do something. And then we won the Farming Hero Award at the Farmers Guardian Awards, which I guess was a turning point. And we all sat down the next morning, having picked up this award, and thought, right, we've really got to do something with this. So we downloaded the paperwork off the internet, and we applied to be a charity. And next thing we know, it had all been approved. We got trustees on board from around the country, industry figures. And then we were a full-blown charity, and now we're a charity who's helping out with the Cumbrian floods. So it's sort of just gone on from there, really.
It's really fantastic work, Ed. Obviously, like you said, you touched on Cumbria. What's the situation like now?
I suppose we are downscaling our operations up there this week. We've moved, I wouldn't like to put a figure on it, but it's certainly over 50. We've moved over 50 loads up into Cumbria. Yeah, so we're sort of slowing down our operations up there, but we've had a really good team of people up there working with us doing the distribution. But the one problem, again, as it was back in Somerset, the one biggest problem we've had has been the haulage side of it. People are very willing to give haylage free of charge and forage free of charge, but it's just the haulage that kills it, which is, again, what we've struggled with. But we've learnt a lot from this operation up in Cumbria, and have learnt some lessons, and we'll be putting them into effect if and when there is a next time.
If and when there is a next time, what would help the haulage situation? What would make that easier?
Every time it's only the second time, third time we've done anything, really. But every time we do, we're gaining more and more support. But it's just having access to maybe a database or something with a network of hauliers on it. Or, you know, getting involved with the Road Haulage Association or something like that, just to get... Haulage is expensive, and that is a trouble. You know, every load I sent here from my farm to Somerset was £700 to £800. And that's what it was costing to move a load. And obviously Tesco's, Full Markstrom did it all free of charge. But it's getting the other supermarkets on board and, you know, the other big haulage contractors in the UK like Stobart or DHL or, you know, someone like that, just to really, really move things forward. And, you know, we need those sort of big haulage companies behind us.
Now, Ed, you've had a busy winter with all of this going on, and you also took part in the Challenge of Rural Leadership. What was that like?
That, and I know everyone else who has been on this show has said it, it's very, very, very hard to describe what that course is about. You're put in the middle of nowhere in Devon with 18 people you don't know and have never met, and you're plunged into it for 2 weeks. It's amazing how you all get on, and the participants are picked very carefully. We've all gone in there, we've done this course, we've learned so much about ourselves and everyone else, a lot about leadership. You do come out a different person, and it's sort of changed the way I look at our business, changed the way I look at managing staff, and changed the way I go about, you know, day-to-day life. And it just makes you question some of the stuff you do and why you're doing that. But what is, you know, more important than what we've learned is it's the network of people we've gone away with. And we're already planning our reunion for next year, which is going to be in Poland. There was a chap from Poland on the course called Pavel. You know, we're going out there to meet him and look around his large farm and it's all about the reunions, the meeting people, and the Worshipful Company of Farmers have been brilliant, and they open you up to a whole network of different people.
That sounds fantastic. Now, British farming is in turmoil, really, I think we could say, at the moment, and one of the topics which is only going to become more and more of a hot topic in the coming months is Brexit. What are your thoughts on this, Ed?
Well, that is a very interesting question. My personal views at the moment, because we've got a lot of debates coming up, a lot of young farmers' counties are putting together debates, a lot of agricultural societies are putting together debates with, you know, fairly high key speakers. But my view at the moment is I think we would be mad to come out. I think there's a lot of people going round on the vote out brigade saying to the farmers that if we come out of Europe, we're going to get all our chemicals back and we're going to lose all our red tape overnight. Well, unfortunately, that is not going to happen. I think all these commodities are all traded on a global market. You know, we're not just trading in the UK, we're trading on a global market. And if we can do that as Europe, as one, I think we're better off. We are, in Europe, a small fish in a big sea. If we come out of Europe and are trading on our own, we are going to be a tadpole in an ocean. And that's what does worry me about it. And from a youngster's point of view, travelling around Europe is very easy at the moment. And, you know, we can walk into any country we want in Europe, and it's a great thing to be a part of. But, you know, if we were to come out of Europe, I just don't think that would be the same. But, you know, we've still got sort of three months until the vote. But what I would urge people to do is, whatever way you're going to vote, get out there and vote, because you won't get another opportunity to do it. And your vote really, really will count.
That's a very interesting point of view. Ed, thank you so much for joining us on The Farming Show this morning. It's been brilliant to talk to you. And we'll let you get back to the farm.
Thank you very much for having me on, and have a good day.
Cornwall's Farming Show on Pirate 2.
Many thanks to Ed for joining us.
It's time for a quick break now, but on the way next, we'll be catching up with James Coombe for a Duchy College diary update.
Pirate 2.
Rubbish, 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 rubbish. If you're fed up clearing up, Nick Ferry skips are here. Skips big and small will do the job. We're number one each year.
We do stone, gravel, bricks and aggregates in dumpy bags or loose, all at unbeatable prices. Why go anywhere else?
Nick Ferris does it all.
Call Penryn 376-292. Blimey, Nick Ferris has expanded to double the size. No, he hasn't eaten too many pasties. He's opening a new site. So there's a Nick Ferris skip hire in Penryn and now Longdowns. Double the skips, double the service.
Nick Ferris does it all.
But bigger. Search Nick Ferris Skip Hire.
Cornwall's Farming Show.
Welcome back to The Farming Show on Pirate 2.
It's time to welcome our next guest onto the show, James Coombe.
Cornwall's Farming Show on Pirate 2.
Morning, James. How are you today?
Hi, Emily. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So we're well into spring now, James, and well into a busy time. What's been happening on the farm with you?
According to the date, we are fairly into spring, aren't we? But the weather, although it's been nice for a couple of weeks now, is the first dry we've had for a while. So it feels like a bit of a late spring. And also with temperatures, we've had some nice warm days, but the grass is taking a while to get going. So we'd like a bit more warm weather, but we'll probably actually be pleased with a little bit of rain in a minute just to freshen things up. But back to answer your question, really, we've been right in the mix of lambing and calving. Lambing is finished at Stoke Climsland. The 100 sheep that we've lambed here have all finished, and most of the lambs are now outside, and lambing's gone reasonably well, so thanks to everybody that's been involved. We had a lambing open day here at Stoke Climsland two Sundays ago, and we had about 1,500 to 2,000 visitors, so we were very pleased on a nice sunny Sunday. And then up at Bicton, we currently lambing the mule flock that's on the farm of 128 ewes, and there was also a lambing open event there this past Sunday, and we think there was probably about 5,000 people attended, so that was quite an event as well. We're calving both at Stoke Climsland and Bicton at the moment, both moving on through calving, so yeah, busy time as far as livestock's concerned. We'd like to start turning some animals out. We're just needing a little bit more grass before we can do that. And on the fieldwork side, we've been getting land ready using the students' considerably to allow them to drill, which was one of the specific parts of their curriculum for the spring. So they've been ploughing, cultivating and drilling spring barley. We've been planting Peppino, the variety, and another newer variety called Sinette, which we're trying this year. We've also been muck carting and spreading muck in preparation for ploughing land for planting maize under plastic in early April. We've also been spreading fertiliser, the first round on the farm of urea. We've put 40 kilos of nitrogen and a hectare on as an early dose. It wasn't as early as I'd like it, but it was as the weather had allowed. So that's a reasonably brief roundup of what's been happening on the farm in the last couple of 3 weeks.
Sounds like a busy time. Just going back to your Peppino, your spring barley that you're drilling, James, what sort of drill do you use?
We use a weaving tines drill, so it's a 4 metre air drill. It just pulls a tine through the soil and just drops a seed into the ground. It's a relatively new drill that we lease from Weaving Agriculture. It does a good job. I always think disc drills are more accurate in terms of their placement, but it's a machine that has treated us well and does allow us to keep going when soil conditions get quite sticky in the autumn time. So that's one specific benefit of it.
And have you been dressing your seed? Are you using dressed seed?
We are. Rightly or wrongly, you don't home save anything. Well, it would actually be quite difficult because most or nearly all of our cereals or all of the cereals that we grow are made in either to crimped grain or whole crop. So we don't really have anything that we could home save. And from a royalty point of view, I've felt the whole situation would be easier if we bought fresh seed each year. So that is what I do. And it's usually dressed either with a standard seed dressing or something more suitable to going in after a grass lay if that is the case.
What sort of thing do you look for to dress your seed with if you're going in after a grass lay?
Just something really that will cope with perhaps leather jackets and wireworm and the insects that you can have a problem with after grassland. You might be able to correct me. I think, is it frit fly that might be an issue after grass? But I know there's a variety of insects and bugs that like to have a go at the seeds that we plant after a grass lay has been turned over. So basically it involves spending a little more money on a heavy-dutier seed dressing to address that as much as we can.
Just going back to the lambing open days, James, why do you think that it's so important that those events happen to engage with the public?
In general, not specifically to do with lambing, but it's just really important that we explain to the public and give people that don't have links with agriculture the opportunity to come and see, you know, where their food comes from. You see milk on the shelf in the supermarket, how does it get there? Lambs that you see in the fields, you know, how are they born? Where do lamb chops and legs of lamb come from? Also, it gives an opportunity, A, for people to learn about that side of it, to get out in the fresh air, and also a chance to ask some of the more difficult questions, if you like, that perhaps things that people understanding about farming, which may or may not be right. And they just have the chance to perhaps speak to a farmer, speak to somebody that is involved in that type of work all the time and, you know, ask the questions that they may not usually get the opportunity to. So I just think we are an important part of the countryside in keeping the countryside tidy and producing food. And we do claim taxpayers' money basically from the Common Agricultural Policy as well. So I just see it all round being very useful that we take every opportunity we can to give the public the opportunity to find out what farms are all about and, you know, where their food comes from and ask any questions, really.
There's been quite a lot of coverage in the media recently, James, about dog attacks on turned-out lambs and dogs worrying ewes. Is this something that you have problems with footpaths going across the farm?
Yeah, it is always a concern. We don't have too many footpaths going across the College Farm at Stoke Climsland in particular, which is something that I'm quite pleased of, really. I mean, obviously, we don't want to restrict people from walking on footpaths, but it's another thing to manage when there is a footpath across your land. So we only have 3 specific footpaths, if you like. They might cover or cross more than one field. We do think carefully about where we put the sheep at certain times of the year, and we do have, unfortunately, a number of conversations with dog owners through the year about putting their dogs on leads and keeping under control. Some dog owners are very good and some aren't very good, unfortunately. We have put up some of those NFU signs, the small yellow rectangles on the entrances to footpaths, warning dog owners of the reasons why we ask for them to be kept under control. And I think it does also point out on there that we are allowed to do something about dogs if they're not kept under control in conjunction with the police. But in summary, we don't really have a big problem, but it is something we're always aware of, basically.
And have you got any update for us on the milk price?
Yes, I can't remember exactly what our last discussion was, but we've been offered on both of the dairy farms that we're involved in here at Stoke Plimsoll and at Bicton College, we've been offered the new Dairy Crest balancing contract. I've signed the contract for Stoke Plimsoll. I'm still in discussions about Bicton because of the number of cattle that we lost to TB in 2015, and I've requested a reallocation of litres to factor that in. But it is going to mean we will have to reduce production in 2016 compared to 2015, and any excess litres that we do produce will be worth considerably less than the main price we're getting for our main litres. So the outlook for milk isn't good at the moment. We're not quite sure how soon it will be before there's some signs of an upturn in the market, but I'm not expecting any particularly positive news this year, and we're just trying our hardest to reduce our cost of production and save money wherever we can. And in the meantime, if we knew this was going to be the situation for 5 or 6 years, we'd probably have to take substantial action now compared to if we knew it was going to be for a year. But at this stage we don't really know, but I think the market will rectify itself, i.e. a low price will fix a low price eventually, but it's a case of perhaps how long that will be. And you know, there's always talk about what is the demand for dairy products, is it reducing versus is it increasing in parts of the developing world, and I think there is still strong demand, but I also think we'll possibly be in a period of low prices for at least the short to medium term, and quite how long is still hard to tell. But yeah, it's tough, basically. That's the bottom line.
James, it sounds like you've got a lot on your plate at the moment and a busy time ahead. Well, we wish you a very happy Easter from the Farming Show, and thanks again for joining us.
Well, thank you very much to you and Rob, and speak to you soon after Easter.
Thanks very much, James.
Cornwall's Farming Show on Pirate 2.
Many thanks to James for joining us.
It's time for a quick break now, but on the way next, we'll be hearing all about sulphur from Donald Messick of the Sulphur Institute.
Pirate 2.
It started with a repugnant whiff lingering in the air, then a strange gurgling under the patio. It didn't sound good. Lifted up the drain cover. Oh my goodness, this was beyond DIY. This needed experts. How much was this going to set me back? One call to ClearFlow, and I knew I was speaking to the right people. They have a fixed price for clearing blocked drains, so I knew the cost before they arrived. With crews on standby all over Cornwall 24/7, they arrived in a flash and cleared the blockage just as quickly. As part of their service, ClearFlow always looked for the underlying cause and told me straight the problem could soon be back. So they talked me through my options and how they could make sure the drain wouldn't block again with state-of-the-art diagnostic equipment and no dig repairs that could fix the problem without destroying the patio. Now that is the complete service. Call ClearFlow, the drain and tank specialists, on Redruth 821000 or search online. ClearFlow, providing drainage solutions. Terms and conditions apply.
Cornwall's Farming Show on Pirate 2.
Welcome back to the Farming Show on Pirate 2.
I'm pleased to welcome our next guest onto the show, Donald Messick of the Sulphur Institute.
The Farming Show.
Don, welcome to the Farming Show this morning. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, you're very welcome indeed. Now then, first up, Don, please introduce yourself. Tell us where you are, what you're up to, and why you're on the show.
Well, I'm in Washington, D.C., and I've done a lot of work with sulfur throughout my career, and I wanted to talk to the farmers in your region about what comparisons we've seen between what's happening in North America and what's happening in Europe, particularly the U.K.
I understand, Don, you spend a little bit of time in the U.K., so you understand our sulfur story. Of course, majority of our listeners will probably be familiar with that, but for those that are not, can you just talk to us about sulfur within the U.K. and its importance, please?
sure. The dramatic thing with the UK is what changes we've seen with atmospheric deposition. In the 1970s, for example, there were quite a bit of sulfur dioxide emissions, and a lot of that sulfur dioxide would come back to the soil and actually be fertilizing the crops. We don't have that scenario happening today. We've really done a good job in cleaning up the atmosphere in both North America and but particularly in the UK. And now we're seeing not that source of sulfur going into the crops, so we have to apply it ourselves.
Is that a problem that you're seeing across North America as well?
Yes, particularly two crops that come to mind rather quickly that we have in common would be oilseed rape and wheat. Oilseed rape removes about 3 times the amount of sulfur per unit area as wheat does, so we know that's a good indicator crop for deficiency. And in the UK, most of the advisors now, in the mineral soils anyway, are pretty routinely applying sulfur for oilseed rape production.
Why is sulfur such an important nutrient, Dom?
Well, we hear about amino acids and protein formation and these types of things, and there are a couple of amino acids that are very critical and have sulfur in them, and these are important to make proteins, so it's important for the growth of the crop, and it's important for the quality of the crop.
Sulfur has quite an interesting relationship with nitrogen in plant growth, doesn't it? Could you talk our listeners through that a little bit, please?
Sure. Nitrogen is in a cycle that we are very familiar with, and sulfur is in a cycle as well. So both are contained within organic matter. Now, if you look back into like 1980 or whatever, that when the responses were first seen, this would be on grass and silage crops, but you'd have a low sulfur soil supply, you'd have low organic matter, and high nitrogen use. And what was happening was you're getting the nitrogen producing to a certain point, and then the sulfur would be deficient. It's what we call, as agronomists, the law of limiting nutrients. So you're applying more nitrogen than you needed, and you needed the sulfur in order to boost it further.
So who are you working with currently, Don? What's your work?
Currently, we're doing a lot of work out in Asia, taking a look at, as they've increased crop production, what deficiencies are occurring with how much is needed and where it's needed and what crops. Historically, we've done a lot of work in Europe, starting in the UK and then spreading over to France and Germany. We've done some work in Eastern Europe, over into Poland in particular, and then, of course, here in North America.
How do you source sulfur as a raw product? And talk us through that journey from its original source through to application.
Well, the old story was it would come from volcanoes, and that's true. Particularly in Sicily, was well known for producing it. But the world's changed. We're in a situation now where, as we've cleaned up the atmosphere, what we're doing is refining the oil or taking a look at natural gas and removing the sulfur from that. So now it's predominantly a byproduct of the energy business. So it's a 70 million ton production per year about. So it's a significant production.
Describe it to us. What is it like in its physical state?
Well, it comes out as a molten form when it's in the refinery, and then it tends to be formed and then shipped around. The important thing to remember, though, is that this form that it's shipped around in is not what we want in agriculture. Elemental sulfur in that form has to be oxidized, and for that we need to make some changes to the product in order to make it usable in agriculture.
Can you just talk us through that process?
Well, we look at a couple different things when we talk about sulfur. Plant roots are looking for sulfur in the sulfate form. So if it's not already in the sulfate form, it has to go through a process in the soil to become in the sulfate form. And that elemental sulfur does through oxidation. So the crops are looking for that. There are several products. One problem that we have is that when I joke with my colleagues who are involved and say potassium, you only have a few materials to deal with. But we've identified about 25 different commercially available sulfur-containing sources. So it's important that you know your source, you know whether you're applying a sulfate form, whether you're applying a sulfur form, and whether it could even be nowadays a combination of the both. The sulfur giving immediate availability, sulfur as it's oxidized becoming available.
I want to apologise, Don. You can probably hear lots of crunching going on in the studio at the moment. Both Emily and Georgia are eating their Easter nests and it's making a right racket here. I can barely concentrate, but I'll persist. What is the relevance to, in your view, to the southwest of England, high rainfall, grassland and so on? Is this as important a nutrient for grass as the oilseed rape you mentioned and so on?
Yes. It used to be that we looked at multiple cut grasses And then we would say that, okay, well, the multiple cuts after we get the second crop and onward that we want to be applying sulfur. But that's now changed. We take a look at all the various cuts. And on the lower organic matter soils or the sandier soils, particularly we expect to see a deficiency. And certain chalks that come throughout the UK, we look at those as well.
From an agronomic point of view, Don, when you're looking at crops, what are the key ways of recognizing a sulfur deficiency?
Well, it's a yellowing, and that's part of the challenge. Many times we see a yellow crop and we immediately think it's a nitrogen deficiency, but that's not always the case. It can be sulfur. So for oilseed rape, for example, we look for stunning of the crop, interveinal yellowing of the middle and upper leaves, and pale flower petals. So as you can see, I'm really describing what could also be confused with a nitrogen deficiency.
And that's also really confused quite often with wheat, isn't it? Does it tend to be the younger or the older leaves that sulfur affects?
Well, it's younger before the organic matter starts making sulfur available, we see it. But as the crop grows, we see nitrogen deficiency on the lower leaves as the agronomic response. Many times with early, we just see a yellow crop. But it tends to be nitrogen deficiency on the lower leaves, and then as you look for sulfur deficiencies, it's in the upper portion of the plant.
And what about the cost of sulfur, Don? What about the potential for returns?
Well, I'm not familiar with the specific cost for sulfur in the UK, but I will say that taking a look at some of the past numbers that I've seen, you're not talking about a high volume input compared to, say, nitrogen. So if you have a deficiency, you want to make that correction. And you get the nitrogen efficiency, you get the added growth, you get added quality, and it's not an expensive input.
If listeners are worried about sulfur deficiency or they want to find out more about the Sulfur Institute, where can they go to find out more information?
For the Sulfur Institute, you could go to our website, which is www.sulfurinstitute.org, and that's with the PH. Sometimes you'll see sulfur spelt with the F, but this is with the PH. And then speak to your advisor. Home flavor is certainly the best way to go. And I mean, this is coming from a guy sitting in North America, but I know with working with the growers that I do, they like to talk to local advisors, their conditions, their soils, their crops, and what types of things they're seeing.
Don, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning. That's a fascinating update on the sulfur story, and I know a lot of our listeners will be keen to learn more, so thank you very much for your time.
Well, I appreciate the time that you've given me, and enjoy that Easter basket.
Cornwall's Farming Show.
Great to hear from Donald this morning. Sulfur's quite an underrated nutrient, really, isn't it?
Well, it is. We talk about nitrogen, phosphate, potash, magnesium, but maybe sulfur gets less of a profile, but I think we know it's just as important. I mean, clearly in the southwest, it's a critical plant food for grass, Emily, but we've learned something this morning, and that is how noisy Easter baskets are.
Maybe we can post one to Donald.
Yeah, we could.
FedEx.
That's it for this week's show. Thanks for listening. Don't forget you can like us on Facebook. Just search The Farming Show on Pirates 2. Plus, if you want to re-listen to anything you've heard on this week's show or any of our previous shows, you can download the podcast at pirates2.co.uk.
We don't need FedEx. We can have Fed Eggs.
Fed Eggs. enough.
Join us again next Sunday at 7 a.m. for another instalment of The Farming Show.
We'll see you then.
Cornwall's Farming Show on Pirate 2.